Okay, by golly, we are ready. I just put up a few of the formulas we derived toward the end of last lecture. When you have a quadrupole radiating, this gives this angular distribution of power as a function of angle in space. It's kind of these complicated directional vectors dotted and crossed into the quadrupole moment tensor for a monochromatic system, of course. And then the total power radiated is this formula. So I thought I'd give a simple example, and then it helps maybe to visualize what quadrupole radiation, how it's kind of qualitatively different than dipole radiation examples we've seen. So one of the simplest distribution of few charges that looks like a quadrupole, its lowest multiple moment is this second rank moment, would be to place at the origin a charge minus 2q. And of course, we're assuming it's oscillating monochromatically as before. This is a bit of an abstraction because this makes it seem like charge is appearing and disappearing at this point, which is unrealistic, of course, but anyway, we're just looking for a kind of a simplest system that would have a quadrupole moment and would radiate quadrupole radiation monochromatically. And so this is pretty easy to do the math. We have Q1, which has magnitude Q at 0, 0, d, if these distances are d. And we have Q2, the middle one is magnitude minus 2q at 0, 0, 0 in Cartesian coordinates. And Q3 is magnitude q at 0, 0, minus d. So you can see that this charge distribution is neutral at all times. It also has no dipole moment. If you could think that one of these minus q's combines with this q to give one dipole, and then there's an equal and opposite dipole from these, the other minus q charge and the bottom charge. So there's like a combination of P and minus P, which means there's no net electric dipole moment. So the leading multiple moment of this distribution is quadrupole, and the quadrupole moment tensor, Cartesian coordinates, remember the general formula going back to chapter 4, was you have to add every charge times this quantity 3xi of k for the kth charge, xj of k minus the distance from your chosen origin, r of k squared, delta ij. And so for this example, qzz will be q times 3d squared minus d squared times 2, which simplifies to 4qd squared, which I will call q naught. And qxx and qxy, I'm sorry, qxx and qyy, you won't be surprised to see that these are equal, as expected from symmetry. And this looks like Q times 0 minus d squared times 2, which is minus 2qd squared, which is minus a half q naught. So I'll eventually write everything in terms of this q naught. And there are no off-diagonal terms. All of the off-diagonal terms vanish in this example. And so we'll need q dotted n hat, first of all, is appearing in all of, well, it's pretty much all of these formulas, which our favorite textbook calls the vector q of n hat. And that would be minus a half q naught times x hat times nx plus y hat ny plus q naught z hat nz. Right. And now I plug in, if you remember, nx is, remember, we're talking about spherical polar coordinates, so we have a theta and a phi coordinate. And so nx would be the usual sine theta cos phi, and y would be sine theta sine phi, and z would be cos theta, the components of the spherical components, or the Cartesian components of the spherical unit vector. So this q dot n hat becomes q naught times minus a half x hat sine theta cos phi minus a half y hat sine theta sine phi plus z hat cos theta. And so we also need n hat dot q dot n hat works out to be, maybe I'll skip a line of algebra, q naught over 4 times 1 plus 3 cosine of 2 theta, which is also q naught over 2 p2 Legendre polynomial of cos theta. So that is this term in the angular distribution of power radiated. We now need that other term. So let's do that. Q dagger Q dotted into n hat. Maybe I'll skip some algebra here too. It's all in the notes, line by line, in painful detail. This is q naught squared cos squared theta plus 1/4 sine squared theta, which is also q naught squared over 8, 5 plus 3 cosine of 2 theta. And so finally, the quantity we're going to plug in for this, the combination of both terms, all right, next, which will give our angular distribution of radiated power for this simple quadrupole example. This quantity works out to be 9/4 q naught squared sine squared theta cos squared theta. There's some simplification. which in turn simplifies to 9 sixteenths Q naught squared sine squared 2 theta, which is the simplest form. Okay, and so finally, dP d omega, the energy per second per unit solid angle radiated out into the universe by this quadrupole, is C squared Z naught, impedance of free space, K to the sixth over 1152 pi squared, 9 sixteenth sine squared 2 theta, which is a rather interesting distribution. If you recall, dipoles, their angular distribution looked like sine squared theta in terms of the angle dependence. Now we have sine squared of 2 theta, so it's quite different. I have a nice picture in the notes, and including the mathematical statement, how I made it. Basically, the main thing is that it's kind of peaked like that. So it vanishes along 0 and pi, and pi over 2. Whereas dipole radiation peaks along pi over 2, 90 degrees to the orientation of the dipole. One thing of interest is to compare the strength of the general strength of quadrupole radiation to electric dipole radiation. I think I've mentioned previously, like in atomic physics, it's usually most systems dipole radiation dominates unless it's a forbidden transition for electric dipole. In a few interesting cases, like the 21 centimeter line of astronomy, magnetic dipole dominates. But you don't normally find electric quadrupole playing an important role unless the others vanish. So let's just check the orders of magnitude at long wavelengths. That's where the multiple expansion is converging rapidly. Do you have a comment?
When AML people say forbidden transition, do they mean that there's a rule that says it doesn't happen, or is it like how astro people say it, where it just takes a very long time for it to
Usually it means in one level of approximation, it's forbidden. But yeah, all transitions are ultimately allowed, almost all. For instance, if you have barium, maybe the ground state is J equals zero state, and the first excited state is a J equals two state. And it's quite rigorous that electric dipole can't happen because of the Wigner-Eckhart theorem. You can prove that no electric or dipole or magnetic dipole radiation could happen. And this can only go by a quadrupole radiation. There are some So that would be a case where it's not forbidden, but it's allowed for electric quadrupole, and it will have a longer lifetime. But a more dramatic case is strontium. If you look at the 88 isotope of strontium, where the first excited state is J equals zero, and the ground state is J equals zero. And so you can prove quite rigorously there is no one photon transition allowed, period. That's an absolute. But this state still does decay. It has to go like that, yeah, with two photons. Then it's allowed. It's a really interesting case. But if you go to 87 strontium, which is what the next generation of atomic clocks is probably going to be, I think it's going to be decided probably this year.
There's a committee that decides what atom and isotope to
use? Well, basically, yeah, based on experiments that are being done, like in Junyi's lab and by Takagi in Japan. And, this transition is very, very weakly allowed because this has hyperfine structure. And so it's actually not total angular momentum J equals zero. It's like I nuclear spin is like 7/2 or 9/2. Any of you remember? No. It's one of those. And so now this transition is allowed, but it's so slow. Its lifetime is, I think, like 1,000 seconds, something like that. Like millihertz decay rate. Anyway, so yeah, there are different levels of forbiddenness. It's a good question. Yeah, I'm doing orders of magnitude. So I wanted to compare the kind of general strength of E2 over E1 radiation from the formulas we derived, the ratio of the amplitudes. This will look roughly like, if you look at the formulas, like KQ over the magnitude of the electric dipole, which Q being of the order of QD squared, and then times 2 pi over the wavelength, divided by the typical size of an electric dipole, which would be Q times the size of the radiator. Right, so this whole thing is of order KD, which is generally much less than 1. That's what we mean by the long wavelength limit. So E2 is suppressed from E1 for a typical system, small compared to the wavelength, by this factor of roughly the size divided by the wavelength times 2 pi. Similarly, one can compare magnetic dipole to electric dipole, see its order of magnitude. This will look like the magnetic dipole moment. If you, I don't have the formulas in front of me, but then divided by the electric dipole moment times the speed of light. This is the order. And of course, M, which is 1/2 integral d cubed x prime of x prime cross j of x prime. This goes, if we think of the currents as charge, charges moving at a velocity v, then this will be of the order of magnitude qvd for the numerator. And again, we can make the approximation QVD for the dipole moment, electric dipole moment, as QD. So this is of order V over C, or of the order of omega D over C. Okay. Which is another way of writing KD. It's the same level of suppression in terms of an order of magnitude counting of KD, of the size of the radiating system divided by the wavelength. So this is basically, this argument is why for atoms that have an electric dipole transition allowed, that's usually going to dominate. good to know and a fun fact to tell your parents next time you see them. Okay, now for something completely different. Okay, my next discussion is based on our text, section 9.4, where we'll treat an antenna again, which we treated before, but we won't go to the simple long wave limit that allowed us to do a Taylor expansion and all the math came out pretty simply. Now we're going to do an explicit treatment of the center-fed linear antenna. Which has some pretty interesting differences in what comes out of such an antenna. When the multiple expansion is not so good because we have shorter wavelength. And so we're going to look at the full integral for the vector potential in the radiation zone. Which is a formula we've written previously, mu naught over 4 pi. You get out to the radiation zone, you get, of course, this outgoing spherical wave with the 1 over r that conserves flux, right, as you radiate outward at one large radius, and then you go to a bigger, like twice as far, the same amount of power going through that second sphere will be equal to that going through the first, and because of this 1 over r. And now we have to integrate over the source, d cubed x prime, e to the I k n hat dot x prime, current density j of x prime. And again, the problem we are tackling is, like, imagine a coaxial cable feed which has connected one end to a linear antenna, another with a small gap going in the other direction to make a long linear antenna that goes up to d over 2 and down to minus d over 2. And this will be our z-axis for the problem. And we could pick maybe a y-axis along the direction of the coax feed coming in, and x-axis out of the board. And this gap is rather exaggerated, the size of that gap. It's usually very tiny. So we'll make an assumption, which turns out to be pretty good, for the current, the way the current is going to look in here. If you remember, we made a very simple linear model when we were doing the very long wavelength derivation for this similar geometry. And of course, I haven't drawn it, but we'll have a vector n hat going out to our detector. So the model we have for the current is going to be, it's a thin wire, kind of we're taking that limit that this antenna is very thin, this metal strip, we're going to take it to be infinitely thin. And then the current will take to be only in the z hat direction, of course, amplitude I naught. And now we'll take this more realistic current, which is sine of kd over 2 minus k times absolute value of z. Of course, we don't want it to be non-zero outside of absolute z equals d over 2. So we can fix that by tacking on a theta function, d over 2 minus absolute z. And to do this integral, we can make the usual replacement that integral of j and stuff d cubed x prime can be replaced for an infinitely thin wire by the integral of I dl prime and stuff. So we'll tackle that integral this way. So a couple of notes about this before we dive into the math. One is that we're using here the same kind of logic we've used throughout the course so far, and going back to E&M1, which is we kind of imagine there are charges or currents, and out, you know, that we specify, and then there are fields. Once you've specified those things, that determines the fields by solving Maxwell's equations. So to pre-specify the fields, pre-specify the sources, currents or charges, and then find or compute the fields produced by those specified sources, that they produce those fields. This picture is, of course, not fully correct. In reality, every now and then we have to touch base with reality. And here's the unpleasant truth. In reality, the fields can act back on those and change the influence the sources, influence the charges and currents. This effect is usually weak. It's usually a small effect. And we'll be neglecting it. But you can find a lot of interest in how in this fact that there is this action of the fields back on the sources. And for instance, you can, if you Google quantum back action, this is a thing that people study. So you might look it up. It's an interesting modern day topic. So the second note about this problem we set up for the antenna is that, again, this is the same problem we solved before, just in a different regime of wavelength. There we solved it in the limit lambda much greater than d, but not here. We're not going to assume that. So we've got an integral to do. Much of physics, theoretical physics, comes down to doing integrals. Okay, I guess I can erase that, but I'll keep my beautiful picture. So in fact, all the integrals in this problem in the far zone are pretty trivial. So let's do it. A of x, again, in the far zone. You have a little different integral to do if you were interested in the near zone or the intermediate zone. C naught. Not over 4 pi, e to the I k r over r. I naught factors out. Now we have an integral over dz prime. Our current. Z prime minus I k z prime cos theta, not theta prime. This integral we could all do in our sleep. Right? You break up this into exponentials, and then you just have a simple exponential integral. We all know how to do that integral. I went through it line by line in the notes, but I think I won't on the board. Let's just jump right to our integral answer. Basically, you'll get this breaking up into four integrals, depending on whether z prime is positive or negative, and depending on whether we use the exponential of this, or I didn't write the other term, e to the minus, and so on. You get four terms, and they can be all combined into the following answer. Z hat, mu naught over 4 pi, I naught, e to the ikr over r, 2 over k. Now, kind of interesting answer, cosine of kd over 2 cosine of theta, minus cosine of kd over 2, all over sine squared theta. And then once we do that, we can quickly derive the magnetic field in the radiation zone. Again, we'll do the usual trick. When a curl acts on a radiation zone vector potential, or any vector that has an e to the ikr over r, and we want the dominant term that goes like 1 over r, then we only care about where the gradient acted on the exponential. It's the only term we have to actually bother taking. So that means in the radiation zone, this curl is easier to calculate as just a cross product of ik n hat crossed into A. It's a nice shortcut to doing the full differentiation in great care and then neglecting all the 1 over r squared terms. And then E field, the electric field, will be Z naught H crossed into N hat. And then the angular distribution of radiated power, which is the quantity usually of greatest interest. This will be the limit as r goes to infinity of 1 half the real part of r squared n hat dotted into e cross h conjugate. So that's the time averaged, of course, radiated power. Now, the vector structure of this is kind of interesting. It looks like n hat, you get all, in this whole field, this whole chapter, you're always getting these weird formulas with lots of n hats dotted and crossed into everything, which are just a lot of fun to play with. Minus n hat dot minus n hat cross z hat. That's basically the electric field direction. And that is now crossed into the magnetic field conjugate direction. And you can tell, for instance, these two terms are going to be at right angles to each other. At least if these are all real vectors. And so this will also be equal to the magnitude of the vector n hat cross z hat squared, claiming. Right, these vectors are each orthogonal to n hat, but their cross product will have a component along n hat, and this will be its magnitude. One thing that you often want to do when you're working out the power radiated is it's kind of a good idea to try to write it in terms of the vector structure of the electric field. And the reason for doing that is that then you can, if you always do that, then you can remember at the end of the day, oh, that also tells me the polarization of the light. Because the polarization of the light is basically the direction of your electric field vector. Okay, so let me just plug in the answer. dP d omega works out to be for this exact, quote-unquote, exact treatment of the linear antenna, z naught I naught squared over 8 pi squared cosine of a cosine minus a cosine over a sine. And this basically, if you think of expanding the cosine in a power series, Taylor series, this would have all powers of KD. So it would have all, basically, all multiples are included now in this formula. Which which is why it's a much more general formula than our electric dipole formula. Now, one thing we should check, of course, is the long wavelength limit, since we derived that previously. Where KD, right, 2 pi d over lambda is much less than 1. And in that limit, this leading order term cancels, and you get the quadratic term in the cosine surviving in the numerator. And that ends up giving that this goes in that limit to z naught I naught squared over 572 pi squared kd to the fourth sine squared theta, which agrees with 9.28, I guess, the equation we derived for that long wavelength limit of the antenna, except the I naught of this model is slightly different than the I naught of the sinusoidal model. And it's written in the notes, but I'm write it here just for completeness. The I naught of the linear model would have to be kd over 2 times the I naught of the sinusoidal model. But the important thing about this is, and maybe it's hard to see this if you don't plot it, but you might experiment and plot it, that if now kd over lambda, just kd, which has the 1 over lambda in it, if that's a big number, you get very, very concentrated angular distribution. It's not this broad sine squared theta distribution that a dipole antenna radiates, but it can be much more directional if you make kd larger. And a pretty effective case that I think is often done in designs is to make, is it d over 2 or d? I think d is a half of the wavelength, is a pretty efficient way to make an antenna. Okay, that ends section, 9.4, I think. I noticed some sadness when we left waveguides. But now you can rejoice, we're going back to waveguides. And some new physics we can tackle about waveguides with our new tools. And I think we're starting section 9.5, the last section before we get into spherical vector waves next time. We're going to use our multiple expansion knowledge and use that to tackle a source of currents, oscillating currents, that are in a waveguide. Obviously, it's going to be different than electromagnetic waves, just shaking a current and having radiation go out into all 4 pi steradians. Now everything's going to be focused somehow, channeled down the waveguide. So we need to quickly review some results, some of which I did not actually cover, and so they actually are not a review. But part of section 8.12b. And 8.12b talks about the fact that we derived the modes inside, like a TM or TE modes inside a waveguide. Those were the eigenmodes. And we derived these E and H of these eigenmodes that could be propagating in either direction. Plus or minus along the waveguide axis. So for instance, we can write the full electric field inside as the sum of right propagating waves and the left propagating waves, E minus. And similarly for the magnetic field, we can do the same. And then remember that we said we could expand these waves and each of these components into a mode expansion of the eigenmodes. We found the eigenmodes we're using, solving the two-dimensional Helmholtz equation. And we found modes like then E of plus or minus, I'm saying, could be expanded with some unknown expansion coefficients, A lambda plus or minus, times the actual mode field, electric field, plus or minus. You had to keep track of the sine of K and all those formulas. Because if they were left going, you had to change the sine of K in all those formulas. And similarly, we can expand. This A is not a vector potential. This is just an expansion coefficient. Don't confuse it with the vector potential. I've run out of letters. But in fact, of course, they are correlated once you know the expansion of the electric field. The same coefficients will expand the magnetic components of the magnetic part of those eigenmodes. And now the modes obey some interesting orthogonality relations. Which are given in detail in the text, chapter 8. Those equations, 8.131 to 134. And in particular, the transverse fields have an orthonormality relation that I will just state without proof, or you can look them up when you need them. We will first write E lambda for the plus or minus propagation directions as a function of x, y, and z as the eigenmode E lambda of x and y. Plus a possible parallel component that would exist for a TM wave, EZ lambda, if it's TM, multiplying its e to the plus or minus IKZ, and similarly H lambda plus or minus will be have only one slight difference. It will have a plus or minus in front of the H lambda, for the magnetic field eigenmode, plus HZ lambda, which will exist if it's a TE wave, but only with the dependence on the x and y coordinates. Again, we were always in that part of the chapter only looking at waves with an e to the ik lambda. Sorry, this is e to the ik lambda z. All the z dependences of that simple form. So let me write the transverse component orthonormality, and there's an assumption here I'm making is I'm going to assume the field modes are real. So I don't have to carry along some complex conjugation. If you remember, they all came out of solving a real PDE with real boundary conditions. And so we have the freedom to choose only real solutions if we want. And I'm making that choice. So for the standard normalization, once you normalize these field modes, lambda does not mean wavelength now, it's just an index, dA is delta lambda mu. That's what we like to see when we want to see orthonormality. And there's a similar relation for the magnetic fields, H lambda dot H mu dA is delta lambda mu, but there is a normal diagonal element, which is this z lambda squared. You have to keep track of. And interestingly, there is a kind of orthonormality relation in the time average power flow down a waveguide. Which is this relation, 1/2 the integral of E lambda crossed H mu dotted into Z hat dA is delta lambda mu over 2 Z lambda. And if that weren't enough, and it's not, There are two more interesting orthonormality relations that these modes obey. And I'll show you in a second why knowing these orthonormality relations is useful. They're the longitudinal components too. Integral of E z lambda times E z mu integrated over the x and y coordinates, the transverse cross section of the waveguide is minus gamma lambda squared over k lambda squared delta lambda mu. That is, of course, for the TM modes where Ez is not zero. And for the TE modes, there's a similar formula, Hz lambda Hz mu dA is minus gamma lambda squared over k lambda squared z lambda squared delta lambda mu. Whew, that's a lot of orthogonality relations. And in the text, they give all of these modes explicitly for the rectangular waveguide, if you want to ever do a very concrete application of these. So we are going to, I mean, you can use these in different ways, these orthogonality, but one way is if you have your waveguide and if someone hands you some fields inside, then you could use the, you know, Griffith's trick, I guess we have been calling it, to use the orthogonality relation to find the expansion coefficients. That's one way you could use it. That's not really our current goal, though, because I'm interested in now putting either a source inside, a current source inside, it's going to send out waves up and down the waveguide, or have waveguides propagating and hit like an aperture in the wall, hit a little aperture. That's going to cause new fields to be created. So let me write that out. These are the two cases we're going to make use of these formulas for. And by the way, I'm not deriving everything in this section. I hope you'll forgive me. So the two applications are, one, localized current source in a waveguide. So we're going to stick inside a J of X, of course, with monochromatic time dependence. And I will state without proof that such a current will produce fields inside the waveguide. And the easiest way to characterize those fields is by giving the expansion coefficients of the modes into the orthonormal modes. And those will equal a lambda plus or minus equal to minus z lambda over 2, the volume integral over the current, dotted into the lambdath electric mode, lambdath electric component of the lambdath mode. But with the plus and minus, note that they're reversed in the mode that you are taking the dot product with. So if I want the A lambda for the plus mode going to the right, I have to do the integral of J dot E lambda of the minus direction. This is Jackson 8.146, if you care, and you do. And then the second point is, second application, is if you have an imperfect wall of your waveguide, a tiny little aperture in the waveguide at one point, what does it do? It generates, if you have waves propagating down of some type, this localized aperture in the wall of the waveguide is going to generate new fields, some going to the right, some going to the left. And we can write a formula for those new waves created by the presence of that hole in the wall. For these additional generated fields, I'm assuming there is an unperturbed propagating field that's coming down and encounters the aperture, propagating E field. And this will generate a field that has the following expansion coefficients. And like I said, I don't think we really need to go through the derivation of all this, fun though that would be. But I wanted you to know that these possibilities exist, and there's a straightforward procedure for calculating them. And actually, in this formula, I should clarify, this E in that formula is the exact tangential field in the aperture. And n hat is outward normal unit vector from the aperture. One tricky thing about this is, maybe I should try to reconstruct the diagram. This will challenge my artistic abilities, but I'll give it a shot. Something like that. So there will be a wave minus ik lambda, z going to the left, there will be a wave going to the right, created the ik lambda z. This e to the minus ik lambda z has a lambda minus coefficients. This e to the ik lambda z plus ik lambda z will have a lambda plus coefficients from that formula. And there will be like this aperture. It will have some E fields inside that aperture. And N hat is the outward normal for our aperture. And so usually you will kind of restrict your integral to this area and view this as generating fields going out to the left and to the right, which will add to the field of the unperturbed wave coming in. Now, this E field is supposed to be the exact tangential field, which we don't know in advance. So that's kind of a catch-22. But at least in the, like if it's a small aperture not making huge fields, you would usually approximate the E field in the aperture by the incident E field, like sort of in the spirit of the Born approximation in quantum physics for scattering. Okay. So all of this is good. We have ways of dealing with a source or an aperture in a waveguide. One thing that's kind of interesting about this is that if you go to the long wavelength limit, suggests like for doing a multiple expansion, then what you can find is it's mostly going to be a dipole moment. You can view either disturbance to the waveguide, either having a new source inside or having an aperture, as having an effective dipole that's going to radiate. And to see this, we want to go back to section 9.5 and treat the multiple expansion for a small source, smaller than a wavelength, in the waveguide. All right, we've done already multiple expansions in Chapter 9 in free space. Now we're going to do it in a waveguide. And basically, the idea is that we can expand our mode fields, E lambda plus or minus, in a Taylor series. And in just the first couple of terms, we're going to have the physics we care about. This does get a little bit complicated, though. So I'm going to use a little simplified notation, like the Einstein summation in convention for repeated indices. This is not a convention like the Democratic National Convention. This is a convention in a different sense of the word. That's one thing I'm doing, and also because the formulas get long, I will omit labels lambda and plus or minus, but you should view them, the formulas, as applying to one mode at a time. And then we'll have integrals like j dot e integrated over a very tiny localized mode, source, I mean, in the waveguide. And we'll do a Taylor expansion. So we'll have j alpha of x, and we'll have first term of the Taylor series will be the electric field component at the center of the source, plus x dot del. It's a nice way to write a Taylor expansion, e alpha evaluated at zero, where you should remember, of course, that the gradient is acting on the E field before you set the argument to zero. If you took the gradient after you set it to zero, the gradient would, of course, give zero. So that's not what we mean by that. It's just condensed notation. Okay, so the main physics is here. We'll have two terms to look at, term one and term two. We still have a few minutes. I guess we won't quite finish this discussion today. Term one equals, can factor out e of zero outside of the integral. It's dotted into the integral of j d cubed x. We've proved before that that's just minus I omega for a monochromatic field by the continuity relation minus I omega electric dipole moment is that integral. Right? P could either be written as this, so not surprisingly, we're going to get electric dipole radiation. Term two is a little more complicated. Integral d cubed x, j alpha x beta, dE alpha dx beta, evaluated at the center of the localized source. And this can be broken down into a magnetic dipole term. Maybe I'll skip that line of analysis in the notes, which looks like j alpha x beta minus j beta x alpha. And there will be an electric quadrupole term, just the way we analyzed equation 9.30. previously. And so term two in the end I can write as, sparing you that algebra, m vector dot b of zero at the center of the source minus I omega over six del dotted into quadrupole tensor dotted into e. At x goes to zero. think I'm out of time. I guess I'll stop there and finish off this chapter next time, and then we'll go on to spherical vector waves. Don't hesitate to come by today or tomorrow if you have homework questions for Wednesday's projects. Is that coming along okay? Have you started? I'm glad I'm not the only one who procrastinates.